Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Axel Key, author of RubyYagi.com. Axel, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Jason.
Yeah, and just for the listeners' benefit, RubyYagi is YAGI.com if you want to go visit it. Where does that name come from? What is Yagi?
Oh, Yagi means goat in Japanese.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, just my favorite animal.
Got it. Did you know that I have three goats at my house? I don't know why you would know that. I don't know why I asked. Do you know? I have three goats at my house.
Wow.
Yeah. We have kind of a hobby farm, so we have a lot of animals, including goats.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So if you ever come to my house, I'll let you pet our goats. So today we're going to talk about Ansible. Ansible is something that I've worked with for some time. I started using AWS to host my Rails apps like maybe 2 years ago, and I got tired of like doing everything manually, and so I started using Ansible to make all that stuff easier. How long have you been using Ansible?
I've been using Ansible for like a few months. Like, I started learning about it like 3 months ago.
And what prompted you to start using Ansible?
It was when I want to deploy my side project, a Rails app, to AWS and DigitalOcean. Then I always go to Google, like, how to deploy Rails app on Ubuntu, right?
Got it.
And then it kind of get tiring after you done it for like the fifth time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for anybody who's not familiar with Ansible and maybe hasn't done a lot of this deployment work, like, what's so bad about it? Why not just not use Ansible and deploy manually every time?
Yeah, so the thing with manual deploy is you have to repeat the command every time, and you might make typo or mistake, then you have to spend another hours to debug it. And say you deploy to one machine, it's still okay. Like, if you want to deploy to 10, then you have to type the same thing 10 times. That's not very scalable, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is, like, the configuration of your server is kind of invisible, you know? Like, you go through the process of setting up your server, and then, like, anybody, let's say you set up a server, and then the next day you die. Then somebody else comes in and they want to like create a second server that has the same configuration as that first server. But like, how do they know how it's configured? It's not like written down anywhere. So that's bad. Plus, like, maybe let's say you don't even die. 6 months later, you want to set up another server, but it's been 6 months and you don't really remember how you did it the first time. And so it's a lot better to have that configuration in code so that you can just run it again. Not to mention that it takes out the tedium of doing it multiple times.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And so this is basically like, if anybody's ever heard of the DevOps principle of infrastructure as code, this is kind of what we're talking about. That's a term that I had heard a number of times before I really like understood what it means or understood the benefits of it. But these are some of the reasons why infrastructure as code is helpful. And also, like, anytime you make, it's not just the initial setup and like creating a new one. Anytime you make a change to your server, it's like, it's so much better to just be able to go into the Ansible configuration and change something than to have to go in and manually apply something to every server that you might have. So, Axel, how do you organize your Ansible code? So Ansible is like the code in Ansible is organized into what they call playbooks. How do can you tell me about like what kinds of playbooks you might have for a certain configuration?
So there's let me see. So I usually have three playbook. Like the playbook are YAML file, YML files. One is for setting up the server, the setup part. Like this server should have Nginx, PostgreSQL, Sidekick and stuff. That's the server setup. And another one is for the environment variables. So every time I want to update an environment variables, I just run that playbook. And then the third one is ad hoc tasks. Like when I just want to test out something or print a command, I will just run that playbook.
Okay.
So that's usually three playbooks.
And so I use Ansible for provisioning my server instances, and I also use it for deployment. Do you use it for deployment too, or just for provisioning?
I only use it for provisioning.
Okay.
For deployment, I use Capistrano.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let me look at a couple. I have my playbooks for my main application up right now, and I'm just looking at them. I have one that I call launch.yml, and then I have another one that I call provision.yml. So if provision, actually, it calls a couple of different ones. I have one that I call provision main, and then one for CloudWatch, which is like, if anybody doesn't know about CloudWatch, it's like the monitoring. My usage for this is like it monitors my disk space particularly, so mm-hmm. that if my disk gets at least 80% full, it will it'll send me an email, because I had an incident once. Check out this story, Axel. I live like in a rural area, hence the hobby farm and the goats. But one day I met up with my friend in the town that's nearby. I live like 30 minutes outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan. So one day I went into Grand Rapids and had lunch with my friend, left my computer here in Sand Lake where I live. I was having lunch. And then after I got done with lunch, my boss called me and he's like, "Hey, the site's down." Oh. And like the site never goes down. It's been down like two or three times like ever. And so I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, I am so far from my computer right now. And so I was just, like, sweating bullets, and I had to drive all the way back to Sand Lake just, like, being so stressed out because the site was down and there was nothing I could do about it. And I had to explain to my boss, like, yeah, I'm really sorry. I can't fix this for, like, kind of a long time because I'm not even at my computer. Then I got to my computer, and I had to diagnose the issue, and turns out it was the disk was full on the server. And so I provisioned a new one, and it was fine. But after that, I'm like, how can I make sure that this never happens again? And if anybody's listening who's like an experienced DevOps person, they're probably like, you idiot, that's like DevOps 101. Should have had that from the very beginning. But, you know, I didn't know because I'm not that experienced in this area. Anyway, so I have my main provision playbook, and then I have one for those alarms. But I'm curious how similar or different yours is to mine, because for whatever reason, I have the separate launch and provision playbooks. And if I just look real quick, so I think the launch one is like not specific to any instance. Yeah, I think this is what it is. Like the launch one, it doesn't have its hands on the instance yet. And so all it can do is launch something. And apparently it creates a security group too. And then the provision one, that is something that I run after I have the instance ID or whatever, and then the provision playbook acts on that particular instance. So how do you do that? How much is yours the same or different from mine?
By launch, you mean like creating a new AWS instances and the VPC groups?
Yeah, new EC2 instance, yeah.
Oh, we use Terraform for that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my company used Terraform for it, like spinning up a new instance and setting up the VPCs. Security stuff.
Okay. And so,
and then and after we set up, we just use Ansible to provision the server.
Okay. How does the Terraform part work?
So it's kind of similar to Ansible, like you specify your provider, AWS, then your region. It's in .tf format, but the specification is really similar.
Okay. So
how did you find
the Terraform documentation? Because I remember looking at that. You know, I was evaluating, like, do I want to use Terraform? Do I want to use Ansible or Chef or Puppet or some combination of some of those things? And, like, I found the Chef documentation completely inscrutable. I couldn't make heads or tails of it at all. And so I'm like, well, this is probably not going to be my first pick. Let me look at some of the other ones. Terraform, I had a similar experience, had a hard time understanding it. Ansible and Puppet was hard too. Ansible was the one where I was like, okay, I've read a little of the documentation. I actually have some hope of maybe understanding this. And then that's what I ended up using. So how did you find the Terraform docs? Were they, you were able to understand them?
I'm not able to understand most of it. Like, I'm just using the template my boss gave me and just make modification on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And so, Terraform, that's made by, it's been so long since
HashiCorp, right?
HashiCorp, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, HashiCorp, yeah. They are a DevOps company, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're using a combination of Terraform and Ansible. Yeah. Interesting. Are Terraform and Ansible talking to each other at all, or do you just use Terraform to create the instances and then you take Ansible after that and use it separately?
Yeah, so Terraform to create the instances, then Ansible to provision the server separately. Yeah. So I run the Terraform script first, then I run the Ansible second.
Got it. Okay. Oh, and here's a question. How do you do your inventory management? Because for me, the way I do it is like pretty janky and it kind of sucks. What I have is okay. So first of all, let me back up a little bit and actually ask a different question before I ask that. So I have my Rails application, and then inside my project root, I have a folder called playbooks where I keep all my Ansible playbooks. And then inside that, I have a folder called production and one called staging, because my playbooks are slightly different for those two, because most of my playbooks just live at the root of that playbook folder. But then inside the production and staging folders, I have my my variable values. So this is where I keep my environment variables for production and staging, because obviously a lot of the environment variables are going to be different between production and staging. And then I have my Ansible variables in that folder. But then also, and this brings me back to the question I was going to ask, I have my host files in there, which basically just have a list of the production endpoints and the staging endpoints for my EC2 instances. But my question I want to ask before anything else is, how do you organize your playbooks? Like, where do you keep that? Do you keep it in your Rails project or do you keep it somewhere else? How do you do that?
Oh, so for my company and myself, we create a new repository, like say the company name Desk Infrastructure. So this repository is containing the whole playbook and also the Terraform configuration. It's all the thing you need to set up the server.
Got it. And do you know why they chose to make it a separate repository, or did that just kind of, somebody else made that decision?
I think it's my boss make it because we want to separate the infrastructure and the application, because we have multiple developers working on the same application and we deploy frequently. So we want to separate these two.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I decided to make mine in the same repo because there just didn't seem like a good reason not to. I've had some bad experiences in the past where there's like an application and we separate things into different repos, and it turns out we maybe didn't have a great reason for doing that. Like, here's one example real quick. we had an application that was like client server architecture. And so we had a Rails repo and then we had an Ember repo. Mm-hmm. But these things, you know, there's this, okay, I'm going to try not to like go on a huge rant here, but like with client server architecture, there's this purported benefit that you can decouple your front end team from your back end team and you can make changes independently of each other. But in practice, I found that not to be true because, like, let's say you do something as simple as like changing the name of a form field on the front end. Well, you probably want to change the name of that database column so that they're in sync, because things are going to get confusing if you let those two things get out of sync. And so pretty much anytime you're making a change on the client side, you're going to have to make a mirroring change on the back side. And you're you like have to deploy those two things together too, or else it like doesn't function. And so that like decoupling benefit is, in my experience, kind of a myth, at least in the experiences that I've had. And so in light of those experiences, I decided not to create a separate repo for this and to put it in my same Rails repo. So that was my rationale. But this is a little bit different of a thing. This is like those same arguments I just made don't necessarily apply, because this isn't like application code for both of those things. Mm-hmm. This is application code and then the infrastructure code. So I could see more of a case for making those two things separate.
We also have the similar issue. Like if I want to update the environment variables, I have to update on both repo, the application and also the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so there's this issue, but it's not very time consuming. So we do it every time.
So the other question I wanted to ask you was about inventory management. The way that I do it is I have what are basically like these INI files. Like I mentioned earlier, and I have these lists of the endpoints of my EC2 instances. And that's like fine, except it's kind of annoying, because let's say I want to create a new instance, like I want to replace a certain instance with a new one. Yeah. I create the instance, then I go get the URL for it, and then I copy and paste that into my config file, and then I like comment out the old URL until I'm ready to delete it. Here's what I do. It's even worse. This is terrible. Okay. So when I create, let's just say I want to create a new instance. I don't even want to delete an old one. All I want to do is create a new one. And let's say I have two EC2 instances existing. So in my config file, I'll have these two URLs. I'll comment out the two existing URLs, then add my new one, and then I'll run my provision script, because I don't want to rerun my provision script on top of my old instances, even though it's supposed to be idempotent, and it is, why risk it? And so I do that way. And then once my new server is spun up, then I uncomment the old two so that all three instances are now in there and I can just deal with them all simultaneously from that point on. But it's like kind of dumb. But I just haven't like gotten to the point of fixing that part yet. So how do you do your inventory management? Do you have your endpoint URLs in files like I do, or do you do it some other way?
I think we have all the endpoint in a host.ini file, and we group it using the square brackets. Do you use the group?
Staging, I do.
Group? Yeah.
Yeah, I have in production and staging, I each have a web group and a worker group.
Similar. So we have a staging group, a production group, and then an experimental group. So we just add URL there. So when we deploy, we just specify the group to deploy to. Like when you type the Ansible dash playbook command, you can specify what group you want to deploy to, right?
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And so is it the case that when an instance is new, it goes in one group, and then when it's provisioned, it goes in like the main group with everything else?
Similar to that, yeah.
Okay. So what you're doing, I'd say, is slightly better than what I do, but still not great. What yeah. what I think would be the good way to do it, there's something called, I think it's called dynamic inventory management. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, but I haven't looked much into it.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
Because this is an issue that I need to deal with like for 30 minutes once every 3 months or something like that. And so it just hasn't been that big of a pain point yet. Because it's a small user base. Like we only have 36 people who use this, maybe even a little less than that, but like not a lot of people. Because it's like it's an EMR for a medical clinic. And so it's just like the staff at the clinic is using this. It's not like some consumer application where we have millions of users or anything like that. It runs a medical clinic. Anyway, I haven't looked into the dynamic host management yet. I had Jeff Geerling on the show some time ago.
I bought his book and studied Ansible from there.
Yeah, me too. Like that's how I figured out how to deploy Rails with Ansible and provision servers with Ansible is from his book, because his book was in a lot of ways better than the official docs, I thought.
It helped me a lot on understanding Ansible. Yeah.
If you're listening, Jeff, which you're probably not, thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, but he had mentioned dynamic inventory management when he was on the show. So that's on my to-do list to figure out.
So my production server, my company has only two servers in production. So, and we are consumer facing. Seems handling pretty well for us.
Yeah, okay. And how frequently do you find yourself having to do work related to the servers and stuff, like kill old ones and spin up new ones and all that?
Very rare. Like at most we would just restart or increase the RAM of the server, like switch to a bigger instances. We only did that like once a year at most. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
And how do you, let's talk about the actual infrastructure setup a little bit. For me, I have here's my production setup. I have two web instances and one worker instance. And if anybody doesn't know like what the distinction between a web and a worker instance is, the worker instances are for like running Sidekick jobs and stuff like that. They don't actually serve requests when people visit the site. So two web, one worker, and then I have a load balancer, which divides the traffic among the two web instances. My EC2 instances themselves are, of course, configured by Ansible. The Ansible playbook says what software is installed on each one of those servers and all that kind of stuff. But the rest of the infrastructure, like the load balancer, I just manually configured that in the AWS console. That's on my list of things to convert to infrastructure as code, but it's just manual right now. How is your stuff set up?
So very similar. So we have a load balancer on AWS, manual configured on the console as well. And then we have two AWS large instance for production. So we host everything there, the web and the worker is in the same server. Yeah, and then we use RDS for the database.
Got it, okay. So, yeah, and your RDS, did you set that up manually or is that configured in some kind of infrastructure as code?
It's manually, yeah. RDS, we just through the console as well and set up the automated backup through the console as well.
Yeah. That's the exact same as me. The only thing that's infrastructure as code is the server instances.
Right.
Yeah. And like in an ideal world, 100% of like in an ideal world, you could just be given a fresh empty AWS account and you could run like one command and get your whole infrastructure back again. That would be like ideal. But this hasn't really like that stuff is touched so infrequently. Like I'm not going to go like mess with my load balancer that much. Although it is. So here's what's kind of annoying. Maybe you've felt this pain a little bit too. Like when I do create a new EC2 instance, I have to go into my load balancer config and add the new instance and remove the old instance from the load balancer target groups. You probably have to do that too, right?
Yeah. But we rarely have to do it.
Yeah. So again, that would be ideal if you didn't have to do that. If there were there obviously is an automated way. It just takes a little bit of work to set that up. And the other thing, so, okay, I'm remembering now, like, I haven't thought about this stuff for my application in, like, months, and I'm thinking about it all again. All this stuff is kind of like, well, it's a lot of work to set all this stuff up, and it kind of feels like too much work. And I had Kelsey Hightower on the show some time ago, who's, like, the, he's, like, a Docker and Kubernetes guy, is my understanding of what he's all about. And we talked about Docker and Kubernetes when he was on the show, and I didn't really understand like what Kubernetes was or what the benefits of it are exactly and stuff like that. But my takeaway after talking with him is like, it's almost analogous to like doing just having an application that's just like a bunch of PHP spaghetti code versus using a PHP framework to build your application. And I'm using PHP as an example because like basically everybody who does Ruby web applications uses Rails. But there's a lot of PHP spaghetti applications out there. It's the difference between not using a framework and using a framework. Like with a framework, they've made all the decisions for you. It's like, yeah, you're probably going to want some HTML templates. You're going to want some controllers. You're going to want to talk to a database. Like there's all this stuff that everybody wants. And rather than having each person individually come up with their own framework and make all these decisions themselves, why not just grab a framework off the shelf and do it that way? And so that's my understanding with Kubernetes. Like rather than do all this infrastructure work yourself and make all these individual decisions, just use Kubernetes and have it make all those decisions for you. Have you gone down that path yourself, Axel, at all, of like entertaining the idea of using Kubernetes?
No, not yet so far. I think it adds another layer of complexity. Like you need to understand how Kubernetes works and how container works. So when you are debugging a Rails app, you have to jump through these hoops as well on production.
Yeah, that's a little bit tough. It's not abundantly clear to me yet, like what's more complex, because like the complexity is there either way. There's no getting around that there's going to be some complexity. It's just, is it more complex to do all this infrastructure work myself, or is it more complex to do the Kubernetes and Docker stuff and do it that way? Because it seems like it might be simpler, like on the other side of learning all that, all those tools and stuff like that, which is a lot of work, but on the other side of that, it might be simpler. I'm not sure what the answer is yet.
Yeah, same here too. But I'm content with Ansible so far with our scale.
Yeah, same here. At our scale, Ansible seems fine, and it's probably prudent to keep it the way it is until things get a lot bigger and the DevOps work gets really time-consuming. So have you done DevOps work in previous jobs, or is this kind of your first job where you're responsible for this area?
Yeah, it's my first job that I'm responsible for DevOps, Rails, and HTML. Yeah. My previous job was iOS developer. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, oh, so it's interesting. A pretty big jump. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so how long have you been using Rails and all this other stuff?
I think I started learning Rails at first when it was Rails 3. Then I gave up shortly after because I was using Windows and I can't figure out how to install it. Yeah. So then I try again when it was around Rails 5.2.
Got it.
Then that time I had a Mac because I was doing iOS stuff and the installation works a lot better and I get to do some CRUD stuff. Yeah. That's how I learned it.
Yeah, that's certainly my experience too. I've taught a number of Ruby classes and Rails classes, and like when people, these are in-person classes I'm talking about, and when people have Windows, it always, those people have so many more problems than the people who have Macs. It's really Yeah, it's a challenge. Okay, so let me see. I'm just trying to think what else. So what's on the horizon for you as far as your infrastructure goes? Does it seem to be working out like the way you have it now for the foreseeable future? No changes necessary, at least the way things are now?
Yeah, I think at most we would just add one more instances or just switch to a larger instances for the current one that is running.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's working out pretty good for us too. And are you guys using Ubuntu or some other distro?
Are we using Ubuntu? Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow, you do a lot of the stuff the same exact way that I do my stuff. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I got a couple other questions for you to change topics completely, as I do on this show so often. So you live in Malaysia. I don't know I don't know if I'm saying the name right. The city is Kuala Lumpur.
It's correct. Well, you spelled it correctly. Yep.
Oh, how do you say it?
Yeah, it's Kuala Lumpur. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's correct.
Got it. Yeah, I like to keep track of all the countries that I've had guests on from. It's something that I call the Code with Jason World Tour. Hang on, I'm gonna pull it up. Code with Jason World Tour. I'm gonna list all the countries that I've had guests on from. When I Google it doesn't come up.
It's the first result, like Reels with Jason World Tour.
Really? I get Jason Aldean tour dates.
Oh yeah. That's weird. I just typed Code with Jason and World Tour.
Okay, I found it. So I've had guests from Argentina, Canada, England, France, Germany, India, Russia, and the United States. So now I can add Malaysia to that list.
Wow, cool.
Nice. Yeah. I've been to a number of countries at this point in my life, but I've never been to the only Asian country I've been to is India, if you consider that an Asian country.
Yeah, it's Asian country.
Yeah.
It belongs to Asia,
That's relatively close to where... Hang on. I don't know my... I got a map behind me on the wall. Let's see if I can even find Malaysia. Oh, yeah, there it is. I see. Yeah, so kind of not actually all that close to India, but it's like a little bit south and to the east.
3 hours time zone difference. Yeah.
Oh, and you're kind of by Indonesia.
They are our neighbors. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'll have to visit sometime. Can I stay at your house?
Feel free to. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been writing about Ruby at rubyyagi.com. Mm-hmm. Last question I want to ask you is where can people go to find you online? Obviously, rubyyagi.com. Can you give us a feel for what kind of topics you've been writing about and what kind of topics you might write about in the future?
Recently, I've been writing about Tailwind CSS, the front-end stuff, and some Webpack stuff as well, because it's new on RailsX, right? Then almost everyone is confused about Webpacker.
I don't even have Webpacker set up on my application. I'm ashamed to admit. That's one of the things on the to-do list to get that going.
Yeah, so it's kind of new experience for me as well, because it changes a lot of stuff. Like, we are so used to SAP pipeline for the past few years.
Yeah, I got really used to the asset pipeline, and then had to change my understanding but it's so much better, because like it seems so dumb that we have like gem files for Ruby libraries, which is obviously great, but then nothing analogous on the JavaScript. It's like if you want to download, I don't know, underscore JS or whatever, you have to like download the JavaScript file and then put that in your JavaScript folder and then like add it to your app. Like, that's how you do it? That seems really dumb. Like, it seems so much smarter to just do like yarn install whatever the package is, and then you have it and it's in your package.json rather than doing it that really old fashioned way. So that seems much better. And then your Tailwind stuff, I can attest that your blog post was a good one, because I actually used that to set up Tailwind on my application.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That helped me out a lot. Okay. So rubyagi.com, will of course put that in the show notes. Anything else, or is that the main place people should go?
For Ruby stuff, yeah, just this, because I have another blog for iOS development, but...
Got it. And maybe we'll have to do a future episode about iOS stuff, because that's something that I know basically nothing about, and there's probably a lot of Rails developers also out there who don't know anything about iOS and would like to learn. So maybe we'll do that sometime in the future. But Axel, thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll put all this stuff in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you too.